You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Afternoon, you're listening to Praxis here on KYRS Thin Air Community Radio. Today, I've got a couple things coming up for you on the show. As you probably heard this week, or have just heard following the news and such, the teachers in LA, second largest district in the country, UTLA, have reached what has been called victory, and I would say is a victory, on many of their demands after 6 days of strike this past week. I was able to talk with one of those teacher organizers, Kirti Barnwal, and she talked with me by phone yesterday. So I'm going to share her interview during the first half of the show, and then I'm going to bring on Brad Reed. He's a local teacher and works with the SEA here to get kind of some local perspective, talk more about education in general, talking about these teacher strikes that have kind of rippled through the country over these last couple of years and seem to have hit some of the less expected areas, you know, California being a blue state and all of that. Teachers in Denver, in the largest district in Colorado, also voted to strike. It's looking like they did not begin their strike today because the district asked the Department of Labor to step in there and mediate. So that could delay the strike really throughout the whole school year and into the beginning of next year. So we don't quite know what's happening there yet. Oakland is expected to strike very soon as well. So yeah, I'm going to share that interview with Kirti from yesterday, and then I'll pop back on, share some more information about the strike, and then we'll have Brad in the studio for some of that local perspective. So here is that interview. I hope you enjoy it. And I also have a link to an article with the same teacher who you're about to hear from down in LA, talking about, it's a great interview where she talks about how she explained to her second and third graders that the teachers were going on strike. So that link is up on my Facebook page at facebook.com/praxisradio. And I'll share it in the podcast when I post that as well. So without further ado, here is that interview with Kirti Barnwal from yesterday. So if you could just start by introducing yourself and talking a little bit about who you are.
Sure. My name is Kirti Barnwal. I am a teacher in LAUSD, second and third grade. I teach in our bilingual program at the UCLA Community School, so it's Spanish and English. It's my 20th year teaching in LAUSD, and I'm also a parent, so I have a daughter who's in second grade at the UCLA Community School as well.
Great. And so, as many listeners probably know, you all just, I would say, you know, claimed victory in a pretty significant strike. But yeah, I guess, can you talk about the strike a little bit and what your experience with that was and some of the conditions that led up to that for the teachers?
Yeah, you know, this contract fight has been going on for the last 21 months, and we've been organizing, we've been negotiating, and the district continued to offer very little, saying that they didn't have any money, they didn't, you know, they had to protect this $2 billion that they had in reserves for when we really needed it, when there was really an emergency. And the union kept saying, well, we're in a state of emergency right now. Like, the district hasn't seen any type of financial crisis in the last 5 years. We, you know, it's like we've been underfunding schools in California and in LAUSD for the last 40 some years, so way longer than I've been teaching. And I think teachers and parents and students just, you know, it's like with the leadership of UTLA, we took it to a place where it hadn't gone in the last 30 years. The last strike was in 89. And I think we walked out with much more than I was certainly expecting from the district. I think we won way more than $2 billion for our community. But I think mainly it was because the contract demands were so not just about workers. They weren't just about teachers as workers. So it was about a pay raise, and I think we deserve that. We never get cost of living increase as teachers, and so we haven't gotten a pay raise in the last couple of years. So it was absolutely about salary and maintaining health benefits, because the district wanted to give us a 6% raise by cutting the health benefits of incoming teachers, to which we had said absolutely not, on a two-tier system for healthcare for mm-hmm. current members and then new members. You know, so unions are constantly fighting around salary and healthcare and benefits that that help to increase the safety net for their workers. But I think the reason we were able to get community involved and get such strong support from civil rights leaders across the country was that this wasn't just about workers. It was about how do we invest in predominantly Black and Latino working class communities, and LA being obviously our main focus, but I'm hoping that it will ripple across to other cities and be a model for how do unions fight for more than just their workers. So it was a pretty dynamic 6 days once it started. You know, it's like when you're in negotiations, you vote at some point as a union whether you're willing to go on strike or not. So we did that last year, and that was 98% of us said yes. If needed, I will go on strike. And we did that. So, you know, January 14th was the first day where we got another offer from the district that was not much better than the last one that they had given us. So the union said, Monday it's on. And I think that first day, about 33,000 of the 35,000 educators, we were on picket lines. It was as dynamic and organic as it was very intentional in the way that the demands were set up and the way that we included community and parents. And so, I mean, the demands that we were asking for were sizes, which obviously affects I think for students and parents, it's really big because that's the quality of instruction that kids are getting in a classroom. And then we went beyond that to ask for, I mean, to me, it's really basic things. And I think I still get upset when I think about, like, we had to go on strike to get these very basic things.
Mm-hmm. Like nurses, right? And counselors.
The district can't, like, the district in the state of California doesn't want to prioritize our students. You know, it's like we're asking for a nurse in every school, and we got that. We're asking for a counselor at every school. We got that in high schools. We were asking for more investment in community schools. So the district is going to designate 20 community schools, and we'll invest some money into making them the model community schools that we could look at. So I'm sorry, it's not 20, it's 30 in the next 2 years.
And can you talk about, I know that means a little bit different things in every state and every district. Can you talk about what you mean when you say community school?
Sure. So the idea of a community school is that you're focusing on the whole child and the whole family. So a lot of our students come into our classroom living in extreme poverty. So, you know, they don't have medical care. Sometimes they're homeless. They are facing, families are facing deportation issues or domestic violence or just lots and lots of trauma from police violence. And it's like children don't come to school and leave all of that outside. So the idea of a community school is, as a school, we are the hub for the community. So we're not just looking at the academic needs of a child, but their socio-emotional needs as well, their mental health needs, their physical needs. So schools that provide like legal counseling for families who are worried about deportation or their documentation status, schools that provide doctors and nurses who can take care of children if they're sick and their family can't take them to a doctor, places where parents can come in and ask for trainings or support, right, or counselors, like if you're in a situation where as an adult or as a child you need counseling. A lot of communities of color, that's not a normalized thing where if you're facing trauma to go to a counselor, but schools could be a place where we do normalize that, because if we had counselors for kids and then that extended to parents, it elevates the level of mental health for everybody. But we're not even able to provide counselors for kids right now. And so the idea of a community school is you're really taking care of the community that is being serviced by the school, not just their academic needs. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And it sounds like a really reasonable thing to do and really efficient, you know, model. And I understand that in California, you know, this year, you all in LA and now Oakland and Denver and some other kind of traditionally blue state places are striking. After last year, you know, we had this wave in West Virginia and some other places where people might expect teachers to be more dissatisfied, I guess. But this is obviously a nationwide problem. And I know a lot of your issue has been similar to an issue that's growing here in Washington around privatization of the school system. To what extent is that a factor for you and your fellow teachers where you're at in LA?
I think it was a huge factor in that the reason that schools are being even more intensely defunded now is because the private sector wants to come in and have schools compete against each other for funding, right? So LA has the most charter schools in the state, I believe. And so one of the demands that we had was to put a cap on charter schools and really focus on the schools that already exist, public and charter, and having charters meet some norms and have some accountability in the way that they run things. Because the way that charters have been able to grow is that they, you know, they'll say that they're better at what they do, and there's no research to prove that. But oftentimes what they're doing is they're asking parents who are more involved, who can fill out a long, lengthy application in English, or you know, students who are already doing well to come and say, we'll give you computers and we'll do this and we'll do that. So attracting a lot of kids and families who are already doing well. And then touting test scores as, hey, look at how great we're doing. But there's been some civil rights lawsuits around not servicing children who are learning English as a second language, not mm-hmm. servicing special ed students, or requiring parents to volunteer a bunch of hours. It's hard for parents who are working class and working multiple mm-hmm. jobs to do.
And they can also kick out kids, right? Like if they're trying to maintain those test scores, they can kick out students in a way that public schools can't, correct?
Yeah, every year we get, you know, it's like April, March, April, as testing season starts, we always get students back from charter schools because they're not doing well at their schools. And it's like, as a public school, we never do that. You know, it's like we take everybody and we service everybody to the best that we can, which is a large part of this contract, is we want to service all of our students. And so as adults, we need more support in that. And we want more of a say in how we do that. So going back to this idea of community schools, right? Like every neighborhood deserves a public school that is well-staffed, where parents and teachers and students have input into the curriculum, can make it be what we want it to be, which is the promise of charter schools, right? Like that it's instruction that's where teachers, where it's like there's, people have more flexibility in curriculum is the claim. And they were originally started as, you know, models for what public schools could be. But since the inception of charter schools, it's gone a whole different direction in this whole competition thing, which has been introduced by billionaires who want to see public services privatized. And so absolutely, we're seeing that fight across the country. And, you know, we won big in this particular contract around that. Generally, with a contract, you can't negotiate things like a charter cap, but we were able to do that because of the community power and the union power that we were able to show. So it's unheard of to get something like that out of a union contract. But I think people are feeling it. And then the demand for like a quality public school in every neighborhood, I think really resonated with folks. And that charters haven't been able to provide that in people's lived experiences, mm-hmm. even though that's the promise. And then right now, Austin Buettner, who's the superintendent in LA, has a plan to break up the district into 32 smaller districts and then have us compete against one another for funding. Which is why I think this fight got as strong as it did, is because people know that that is not going to be providing racial justice in our communities. Where if we let him get to that point, and that was his plan, was we'll fund a couple of things for you all in terms of nurses and librarians and some salary stuff for a year, and then after that we won't be able to do anything, because in the next year they wanted to unfold that and put a lot of funding into basically privatizing the district. So with the 6-day strike, we were able to have them commit to 3 years of increased funding in all of the areas that we asked for, which doesn't mean that we're done. It almost feels like the beginning, and we've laid the foundation on really strong, but it means going to the state and asking for more money as well, and making sure that the district follows through with the money that it's mm-hmm. committed to. But it's not it's not as cut and dry at this point, which is what he wanted, was like after a year we'll basically just not be funding schools that aren't doing well, unless they're like, if they are doing well, and then pouring that money into charters. Mm-hmm. So we were able to reshift that vision and then reinvest into public schools.
Yeah. And I remember his election, you know, even made a blip in national news because so much outside money was poured into his race. Do you see this strike as being also a foundation for kind of reclaiming your school board and the administrative side of things for your district?
Yeah, I think that's the next step. We're trying to get Jackie Goldberg elected to District 5. Jackie Goldberg's been a teacher for years and obviously been a prominent leader at the city level and the state level. So we're working hard to get her elected in March, and then that is to fill, I believe it's Ref Rodriguez's seat, and then Monica Garcia is stepping down, so we have an opportunity to get somebody into her position as well. So it's all moving pretty fast, and absolutely, I think in cities across the nation, just like we did at the federal level, we have to replace the leadership. By the federal level, I mean Congress and the Senate, right? Where we got all these amazing women of color elected in the last election. And so it has to be a balance of electoral politics and then organizing and on the ground pressure, because that's what keeps politicians accountable once they're in those seats. And even with a really conservative school board right now, we were still able to move, move policy, which is good, but it would be easier if we had people who are supportive.
Yeah. And
so, yeah, absolutely.
That leads right into the last question I was going to ask you, which you covered a little bit of, but what would you say for other districts who are starting to organize, but maybe even, I mean, in the wake of this long shutdown, just to workers in general, what would you say is the recipe that helped you all succeed in this strike? And what would you tell others is kind of foundational for doing this kind of work in this day and age that we're in?
So I think for me, it goes back to what I was saying earlier. It's really our demands. It's the vision for what we want for public schools. It's the vision for what we want for our communities. And when we have demands that resonate with people, they will show up. You know, it's like teachers are not a militant group traditionally. It's majority, you know, it's like majority in LAUSD, it's majority women, majority of color. And our profession is known for following rules a lot, but the way that we framed it for our students and the community as well is when the rules are racist and they're wrong, then you break them, and we are not going to go to work because we want a reinvestment of money into communities of color. And those demands drove the strike. It's like, it's the thing that got people saying, yep, I am going to take a huge risk and fight like I've never fought before. And it was absolutely presenting this vision for what our schools could look like. And then I think now we all have these like beautiful ideas of what schools, what we want them to look like, which means that we need to continue fighting for that, because this contract, like I said, is the beginning, not the end. But I do think it was the demands that were inspiring, and then obviously organizing and communicating with parents and students and including them since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking to parents about the contract fight and about what we want and what they want. So like a group like Students Deserve, which is all Black and Latino, they've been organizing for the past couple of years, and their demand, what they wanted, was an end to the random searches that happen in LAUSD, which is just criminalizes young people of color. And so this contract has an end of that policy in 28 schools. That would have never happened had we not included students from the beginning, as we were trying to figure out what do we even ask for that's not just salary and health benefits and class size, which are typical demands for teachers unions. So I think just including people in that visioning and then making sure that our demands speak to a lot of people and that they speak strongly, right? Like, folks are really excited about them.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for for doing it. Congratulations on your win and the foundation for everything that's next.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there will just be more great reinvestment into public services.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll keep organizing and stay in touch.
Awesome. Well, thanks for talking with me.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
All right. If you're just joining us, that was an interview I recorded yesterday with Kirti Barnwal. She is a teacher in Los Angeles. And as she just said, just got off of strike. They just kind of declared victory. I'll share on the podcast a chart of kind of everything they asked for, the pre-strike offer, and then what they got. She summarized some of it in there. But if you're into the details, that is all possible. So you're listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor. I'm now here in the studio with Brad Reed. He's a local teacher, high school teacher over at Shadle and part of the executive board of SEA, the Spokane Education Association, which is the local union. Am I getting all that right?
Yep, that's right.
Acronym-wise and everything.
Yep.
Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I just thought it would be cool to get some kind of local perspective. Obviously, you know, we were talking just now. This district is a very different place than that district, and the history is a lot different. But I don't know. I guess what's just your initial take on what happened in LA this last week, just as a teacher?
Yeah, I think individually, personally, I think the movement in Los Angeles, picking up on the momentum begun in Arizona and West Virginia and Kentucky and Oklahoma, is exciting from a union member standpoint and teachers who happens to be a union member, because I think, you know, for the last 50 years, we've seen direct attacks on organized labor and union membership. And so the sad part is it took conditions in some of those states to be so dire that it forced people into the streets and in defiance of their state governments. But on the resulting end of that, it's exciting to see people understand that when necessary, collective action matters. What also inspired me from the Los Angeles folks is the way that they use the knowledge and results that the Chicago teachers achieved in 2013-2014. So the framing of the issue as one about racial and social justice that the folks in Chicago did and won, fighting the same privatization agenda, was inspiring. And I'm hoping that sort of momentum is able to be captured in future struggles. Maybe it can re-energize union membership and the union movement in general.
Yeah, because, I mean, like you said, I think you called it 50 years, and that sounds about right. It's difficult, and I hear even just, like, average people who are workers saying not necessarily, like, overly hostile things, but kind of, there's not a lot of visible solidarity, mm-hmm. With these teachers or with other
union
workers, even with the federal workers, just this last month during the shutdown.
During our most recent bargain, which was in the summer of 2018, which was simply about salary, because the state legislature in Olympia allocated a brand new pot of money that was designed to address the McCleary decision so they would fully fund public education. They haven't yet, but that's a different conversation. So there were certain districts around the state who opened up new contracts based only on salary. The rest of our contract in Spokane Public Schools remained closed, but because of the legislative adjustment, it had to rebargain a new salary schedule. In the process of doing that, one of my thoughts was, what kind of support will we have in the community if this needs to be pushed to any sort of work stoppage? It didn't, but along the way, we got a ton of support from visible support from the firefighters. We had rallies outside the district administration building, and a ton of community support. I don't know how it would have materialized if it had gone to a strike, because that raises the stakes. And then you've got competing narratives between management and workers, and whose side are you going to join? But I guess I'm still optimistic that down at the core of most people who work for a living, they understand that we're all in it together. Despite the expert strategy implemented for decades in dividing us from each other. So,
yeah, for sure. And so you talked about the McCleary decision a little bit. Washington is a little bit different than a lot of other states in that we have this mandate in our state constitution mm-hmm. regarding funding public education. What does that, I don't know, would you say, does that help our education system compared to other states?
Yeah, I don't know if I can answer that. I think one of the things it allows us as teachers and as union advocates is a platform to stand on so that when the Supreme Court holds the legislature in contempt for not following their constitutional mandate to fully fund public education, that gives our arguments weight. One of the things that I was most proud of before the money came in, before we were able to work through our negotiations and get the salary raises that everybody deserves, was the years of behind-the-scenes intense lobbying on the part of WEA, the Washington Education Association, the statewide teachers union, to make sure and never let the legislature off the hook when it came to funding. So the fact that the legislature actually moved to fulfill the Supreme Court mandate was in part because of worker union member pressure, which was relentless for at least 10 years. So that's part of the story. And because that was a one-time dump of $2 billion, then the next step becomes we, as union members, we cannot let them believe they fixed it. There are still several pieces of the pie which are not fully funded, special education for one. And so while this was a huge leap forward and the result of a lot of hard work, it's the fight is never over, and that's always the case with every struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you mentioned special education. Are there other kind of big buckets of areas that you see as being fragile here?
One of the things that I hear all the time from students and colleagues of mine in other buildings, elementary and secondary, hear from students is that there aren't nearly enough mental health therapists to address the very real issues of mental health awareness that students are encountering and dealing with every day. So there isn't enough staffing resources done to do special education in the correct way. There, it would be ideal if in a special ed classroom, given the population, there was a behavior interventionist, somebody who specializes in how to address behavior intervention in a meaningful way that keeps everybody in the room safe, but also addresses the student's educational needs. That is not funded. And so WEA is also continuing to lobby the legislature on behalf of those kind of programs. And there's a ton more I'm not terribly conversant on, but those kind of things, which often sort of fall through the gaps, are the ones where the statewide organization is remaining vigilant to say, but you have to do this and you have to do this, and it's not fully funded yet.
Mm-hmm. And when that happens, so I know that I can see the way this kind of trickles up, because one of the main school issues I've been hearing about the last few years is the numbers that have come out around racial disproportionality right. in, I guess, like behavioral intervention mm-hmm. and then punishment
right.
In terms of suspension and expulsion and all
right.
of that.
Right.
So I guess that all ties back together. Right.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest struggles. There are several community organizations in Spokane run by and involving parents who are concerned about their children, whether they're kids of color or kids with special needs, who are by the numbers across the board in every level and every building disproportionately punished, disproportionately excluded, whether that means short or long-term suspension. And so the district has taken steps. There is, I believe, once a month or twice a month, a group of people representing community agencies who gather together to strategize how to address that. It's called the Superintendent's Work Group. One of the groups that is heavily involved with that is a group called Every Student Counts Alliance, which is an organization set up with community activists and parents to never let the district forget that this is an issue that has to be addressed. There's a conflict sometimes between what the district and the school practices are in state law. And so if the state law says suspensions have to decrease, you know, if just to sum it up in a single sentence, then the school or the district can label a kid excluded from a classroom as not a suspension, and therefore the suspensions are decreasing. But we haven't addressed the behavior. We haven't addressed the root causes that, because every behavior exhibited by any kid at any age has a message behind it. They're trying to communicate something. A punitive, a sort of command and control approach has never been one that had a chance of working. It's unfortunately one that we're still sort of stuck with the vestiges of. So one of the ways that we're trying to address that is an initiative that the Washington Education Association, in cooperation with certain faculty at the UW Law, or School of Education, put together in 2016, a curriculum, a training to offer to staff around the state called Culture Responsive Classroom Strategies. And it's designed to essentially help students. Well, let me say it this way. We were doing one of these trainings at Shadel in March a couple years ago, and I was in the Commons putting up signs so that those who were coming to the training would know how to get to the library. It's hard to navigate the building, and that was the only door that was open at the end of the day. And a student was in the Commons hanging out, waiting for a ride to go home. And he said to me, "What are you doing, Brad?" And I said, "I'm just putting up signs to help people get to this training who don't know the building." And he said, "What kind of training?" And I said, "Well, it's essentially designed to teach adults to understand better the students that they're sharing the room with, who they are, so they can teach them better." And he said to me, and I quote, "You have to teach people to do that?" Unquote. And in the question, he already answered his own question, and he knew from experience that the answer to that was yes, because even though, and in the last 3 years, we've done dozens of trainings, and there seems to be on the part of many participants this sort of cellular understanding that, of course, you get to know the kid first and then teaching happens. Something about the system we're in has taken that away from us. I mean, nobody got into teaching because they love testing. Nobody got into teaching because they wanted to, assess skills. People got into teaching because they love working with kids. They love ideas unfolding. They want to see sparks of creativity and imagination. And the nature of the system we're in here in Washington, the nature of the system that the folks in LA are in, Chicago, whatever, is one that fundamentally stifles all of that, which makes what the LA teachers and the Chicago teachers did so exciting, because they're pulling back and saying, if we don't address this issue of injustice in the system and how it affects those kids, we're ignoring who they are. We don't see them. We're not validating their story. We're not building a relationship with them. So in the middle of all this system, so your question was, does it help in the system in Washington? In some ways, the system is the problem, right? And one of the things I love about what the LA folks pushed for was community schools. Mm-hmm. The idea that in every neighborhood is a school. And I'm not sure if this was part of their language, but one of my visions is a neighborhood school run collaboratively by students and faculty and parents. Curricular decisions, discipline decisions done in a community way. And we're a long way from that, but I think the victories of organizations like UTLA help move us incrementally forward toward that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what you just described about the training cohort you've been part of and everything, I think the way I've heard things framed over the last 10 years or so tends to be, you know, let's train the teachers more, let's give the teachers more tools. But what you said at the outset was hiring more people who are specialists rather than trying to cram so many more tasks into a teacher's job, which, you know, has gone from that kind of more personal enrichment, that thing that we know of as teaching, to test administration, to behavioral intervention, pretty extreme behavioral intervention, as things get worse in our social safety net in general, kids have higher needs.
That's right.
Generational trauma, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you didn't study any of that.
Well, it's funny because those conversations happen all the time. And one of the things that folks push back with is, I didn't become a teacher to also be a counselor. I didn't become a teacher to also be a social worker, which is entirely valid. Neither did I. But if the experience in the space you're sharing with these people matters and you want it to be a positive one on the end and on the end outcome, then don't you sort of have to commit to knowing those skills, even though you're not professionally trained, right? So yes, we need more specialists hired. Yes, we need more effective resources in managing. I don't know if it helps or hurts that I grew up in Spokane. I went to Willard. And so the school that I went to is no longer there because it was torn down and one of the rainbow schools was built. And didn't have a concept when I was, you know, between 6 and 12 of what, you know, socioeconomic and life factors were at play in my classmates' behavior. Just, it seemed like a sort of ordinary Spokane, traditional, everybody's like this. And so this was my experience. Well, I've gotten to know a number of people over the years, the last few years, who now work at Willard in the same neighborhood I grew up in. And they describe the incidence of fetal alcohol syndrome, the incidence of domestic violence in the home, the scale of poverty, which lets kids know they may not be going home to the same location every night in the same school that I grew up going to. So you're absolutely right. So long as what's out there societally is broken, then those problems are still going to come into the classroom. And so that's another thing I love about what the LA and the Chicago teachers did is they paired their message of working and learning conditions with some countercultural commentary. Like, if we're going to address this because of who's in the room, we have to address what circumstances they face before they get into the classroom. That hasn't sort of bubbled up in the same way in Spokane yet, but Spokane's a very different place culturally than LA and Chicago. So,
Yeah, and it's like she said, I really liked what Kirti said in the interview when she said it's teachers tend to be rule followers.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's evidence that the rules as they are the problem. If you can get 95% of teachers who tend to be an orderly bunch, on the whole, I don't know if present company is entirely included, but so I guess back a little bit into what you were saying around the testing culture. I know that in Washington State, in the Seattle area, there's been quite a lot of kind of testing rebellion over the years.
Right.
Is that a conversation on the state level and locally?
Not to the same degree. I know I've talked to people here who understand and identify with and support the more radical test rebellions, on the West Side. There isn't the same energy. And I think part of it is because of that very thing that teachers tend to be rule followers. It's interesting because as a union building rep, one of my jobs is when somebody is facing any discipline because they did something wrong at work, they need a representative to talk with about the issue or go into a meeting to take notes, be their advocate. And in those moments, it's clear the contract matters as a way of protecting their rights. What isn't clear is that the contract also exists as a matter of collective empowerment. And so, you know, we only got a contract because we collectively organized and demanded what we wanted, whether that was the raise in 2018, the the rest of the current contract in 2016. That's the way union activism goes. And so if there was, I mean, if testing is in fact the evil that we all believe it is, then it seems like there could be a vehicle for collective empowerment over here. So that it just hasn't. I mean, if you raise up testing as an issue for people, we do it in the trainings. We ask people, what are the stresses and challenges that you have to deal with every day that make it harder for you to do the job that you know you want to do? And first, second, or third in every group is testing. So everybody's aware of it, and how, especially at the elementary level, it's just insidious. But it hasn't translated from that moment of outrage to, and maybe it's because they're rule followers, right? We don't like testing, but they told us we have to, so we're going to do it because we follow the rules. There is some potential excitement because there is a push in this legislative session to pass a bill delinking state testing and high school graduation. I don't know if it's going to go anywhere this session, but at least the conversation will start.
Mm. Yeah, my graduating class here was the first with that linked testing and graduation requirement, and I just remember it wreaking havoc from a student perspective, right, and a parent perspective. So I feel like there's definitely a common ground in the Venn diagram of students, parents, and teachers in terms
of
being utterly frustrated with testing, but, you know, threatened with. Parents don't want to tell their kid, yeah, don't do it, because I don't care if you graduate from high school or not.
Exactly.
You know, and for students, it's a big deal, and you either don't have the foresight to know what that might mean.
Right.
Or,
and, yeah. And in a bigger picture, those at least who see themselves as four-year college students then have to enter, and this is the way I always imagine it, the corporate world of the College Board, because you can't get into a four-year school, with a few exceptions, without the SAT, and you can't really master the SAT without the PSAT. And so we've taken as normal that this, I don't know if they call themselves not-for-profit, but they're a very profitable corporation, we've accepted that a profitable corporation can tell everybody what intelligence is. That's essentially what the College Board does. And if you take the SAT and you didn't get as much as you wanted, or your score isn't as high, then somehow that's a referendum on you. And then we wonder why students are stressed.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, and the district, in their attempt to make everything accessible, has for the last several years paid for the PSAT for every freshman, sophomore, and junior. And there's something a little bit unsettling about that, because if you're a high school freshman, you probably don't have a whole lot of concept about what you want to do when you're 32 or 40, mm-hmm. right? And yet this whole narrative starts to shove you down the cattle chute, whether you want to be or not. And so one of the things that I see at Shadle, especially on, and they also pay for all juniors to take the SAT every March, which in some ways is a very generous thing, and it breaks down boundaries of access. That's a good thing. But to actually force students who don't see themselves as college students, or who don't know if they're going to be college students, to enter into this high stakes testing, at least if only for 3 or 4 hours, just, there's something not right about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That is a mixed bag. I really remember it being tied to economics when I was in that position, I don't know, 15 years ago or so.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, if you've taken the SAT 7 times, it's because your parents are wealthy and they really care about you going to a good school.
And they can pay the fee every mm-hmm. time to practice, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, dang. So what do you think, I guess just in the last few minutes that we have, what's your hope for what's next, just in the education system in general?
That's a big question.
I know.
Those
right at the end.
I mean, I in some ways I don't have details, which means, you know, my solutions sort of don't count as much, because people, it's funny when especially in education, if you have a conversation with somebody and you call out an issue which is inequitable, unfair, unjust, then there's an insistence on, well, okay, but what is your solution? So I don't have a lot of concrete solutions, but one thing I do think is absolutely key to success on a small and collective scale for students is a decentralization of schools, which would mean in Spokane, sure, you can have an administrative district which, you know, does some of the innocuous functions to coordinate things, but curriculum and decisions about what happens to people at Shadle is done at Shadle and not some sort of uniform program system curriculum that is done district-wide. As an English teacher, that's been sort of front and center for me and a lot of other people in the last 10 years or so, because the district decided with some teacher input that the best way to teach English was using a curriculum created by the College Board. It's called Springboard, and because of the insistence on the nationwide standardized test, one of them being the Smarter Balance test, focusing on short but meaningful passages of nonfiction, it de-emphasized the novel, which in my experience is why a lot of people got into teaching English, because they loved the stories that they read and they wanted to teach them again. Springboard as a curriculum features a lot of short, and they're sometimes really good, meaningful readings, but it's skill-based. Mm-hmm. And that became the curriculum for all of Spokane high schools. Now, there were individuals who chose not to implement it in full or to ignore it, and depending on what building they were in, they were either sort of chastised or left alone. But behind this implementation, which was, and one of their reasons was, if we're all teaching the same thing, if I'm teaching this in January at Shadle and a student transfers from Ferris, because they were also doing the same thing on the same schedule, then when they transfer, that will mean nobody misses a beat. If you're building a curriculum based on picking up people who switch schools, you're clearly missing the point. And what the curriculum did in its standardized approach, and even their argument of, yeah, a kid misses nothing when they transfer, that assumes that kids are interchangeable units. And when they leave the high school classroom, they're going to know that people in their work life, in their personal life, are going to respond to things different. There is no standardization in the rest of human life, mm-hmm. Or at least we hope there isn't. Yeah. I mean, it's happening, right?
Where it's attempted, it usually right. has pretty terrible consequences.
And so why not give them, if we're all about real-world experience training, why not have them encounter different teachers with different styles who do mm-hmm. at different paces and cover different material, and it's still all, I mean, it worked for a while. So I don't know why the standardization had to take it away. So back to my main point, the thing that I think has the best chance, it's also a long ways away, is a kind of decentralization. Big districts, even of Spokane size, there's an inevitable slide toward seeing students as all the same. And all people who analyze education and what needs to be done, they lead off first with, kids are all different, humans are all different, why don't we treat them mm-hmm. that way? One of the best resources for that I can recommend to listeners is a man named Sir Ken Robinson, who grew up in the UK, now lives in the Los Angeles area. He's written several books. He's done several TED Talks about the way education should work is by sparking creativity, and the way schools are structured now, they actually stifle and kill creativity. If there's a way to somehow put in place a program, a policy, a curriculum that absolutely sparks creativity, that's an answer as well.
Cool. Well, thank you.
You bet.
Yeah. I hope that all of those things happen on a timeline we can both witness. How's that? And if you're just joining us at the end of the hour, this has been Praxis. I've been talking with Brad Reed, and before that played an interview with a great LA teacher who just came off of strike. If you missed any part of the show and want to catch it, you can find the podcast either by going to the programs page on KYRS.org and finding Praxis, or by going directly to soundcloud.com/PraxisRadio, PraxisRadio. If you ever need to contact me with show ideas or anything else, you can email me at praxis@KYRS.org. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next week.
Roll right over him. If the boss gets in the way, we're gonna roll right over him.